This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And joining us today to start our show is David Gruel. He is a professor and chair of the Department of Industrial and Manufacturing Engineering at NDSU. And he's going to talk to us about bioplastics because this is Bioplastics Week. Thanks for joining us, David.
Well, thanks for having me this afternoon, Doug. I really appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to you about something that's really I'm passionate about, that I feel a lot of gravity towards, of looking at sustainable materials and how we can leave this earth in a better shape than what we found it in.
So let's get right into it. What are bioplastics as opposed to plastic plastics?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm teaching a class on polymer processing this semester, and that was one of the questions I asked the students, you know, what is the difference between a plastic and a polymer and so on. And when we look at bioplastics, the way I define them is that they are in part, at least in part, coming from a sustainable, renewable feedstock, whether that's plants such as corn or soybeans or possibly a woody material. You know, we see plastic lumber that's often used in home construction and so on. So I would consider that a bioplastic, even though that it's got a fair amount of petrochemical plastic in there. So that'd be a biocomposite. And we often have to be realistic that our products are not necessarily biodegradable, and I have to be very careful about using the word biodegradable. There are ASTM standards that talk about that. And so, for example, with PLA, which is a corn-based plastic that's produced by NatureWorks, PLA is a compostable material. They don't want to call it biodegradable. If you just throw it into the dirt, it may last for many, many years before it starts to really decompose and be taken up by the microbes. But if you put it into a compostable condition, the right temperatures and the right moisture conditions, it'll break down. But that is only one example of a bioplastic. Other examples include things like what Coca-Cola is doing and making their bottles out of a bio feedstock. And so their bottles are up to one-third bio-based, and the plastics are exactly the same as their traditional counterparts being produced from petrochemical feedstock, the polyethylene terephthalate, but one-third of that molecule is bio-based. And so that molecule, that pop bottle, that soda bottle, is exactly a one-to-one drop-in, and it does not degrade. It has the same mechanical, thermomechanical properties as a petrochemical feedstock plastic. So I don't want to get oversold to the fact that just because something's bio-based makes it the assumption that it's going to be degradable in the environment in some way. That may or may not be true.
So there is a sort of synergy here with the existing plastics industry, I take it.
Yeah, very much so. For example, the center that we run at NDSU, CB Squared, which is a National Science Foundation Center, that's modeled after an IUCRC or is an IUCRC, an Industry University Cooperative Research Center. We have several member companies. One is Ford Motor Company and one is Hyundai. We also have another member company, Diageo, that is a spirit producer, and one of the things that they produce is tequila. And when you get done producing tequila, you have these agave fibers, and traditionally these have been thrown away, burnt, whatever. And we've been able to show that we can take these tequila fibers and process them or pre-treat them in such a way that we can put them into a petrochemical plastic and use that in an automotive application. So that's great for companies that produce tequila, but for somebody like Ford Motor Company, it's great because now they can have a lighter weight car. We've been able to demonstrate that the thermomechanical properties of this petrochemical plastic filled with a biomass material has higher specific strength. So its weight to strength ratio is better than that of a glass reinforced composite. And so for the end consumer, we have a increase in car efficiency. But one of the side effects that we did not anticipate was that we saw a significant energy reduction in the processing. So the suppliers, the Ford Motor Company that are making these components that go into your dashboard assembly for your heating and air conditioning, they actually see that they're able to process these materials easier and at a lower energy consumption. So it's a win-win-win for everybody.
Well, North Dakota, of course, has a huge ag economy. It's got an oil and gas and potentially a petrochemical economy that might emerge as well. So after the harvest, there's a lot of corn husk out there. There's a lot of sugar beet refuse. There's perhaps some hemp in the future here. What's the potential for these byproducts?
there's a huge potential. And, you know, depending on the feedstock we're looking at, there's companies out there, for example, Mango Materials, that take food waste and convert that into PHA, another bioplastics. So we can take food waste. We can take agricultural waste, and I shouldn't use the word waste, but co-products, and ferment those into some type of material that can be used as a building block for plastics. So that's one potential path, is taking, you know, sugary type materials and converting them through typically some type of fermentation process to build either a polymer directly, a plastic directly, or some type of precursor to a polymer. But we can also take these co-products, these co-streams, and add them as fillers. And often these fillers have better mechanical properties than what we see in traditional type plastic composites. The up challenge is always separation and pretreatment. These co-streams often are contaminated with a wide range of other products. So there's always the challenge of being able to separate them, pretreat them, clean them up, and get them to a consistent format, because we're working with biomass. And biomass changes from year to year. It changes from plant to plant. And so often those are some of the challenges we have to overcome in order to make these viable and economic. And so one of the things that we really focus on within my center, within the center of CB Squared, is the TEA, the techno-economic analysis, to make sure that it's economical as well as has a positive impact on the environment.
Well, this center you've just referred to includes NDSU, Iowa State University, Washington State University, and the University of Georgia. You were at the Iowa State University before you came to NDSU about a year ago. So this is a research focus at these large institutions. It strikes me there's a fair amount of potential here.
Yeah, there is. You know, it's four sites. So I formed CB Squared about 6 years ago when I was at Iowa State and partnering with Washington State. And each site has a specific type of technology. So when we first formed CB Squared, we had to approach NSF and convince them that
National Science Foundation.
Yeah, correct. That there's no other center like that. And so we were able to convince them of that. They also had to demonstrate that we had the infrastructure, the people, the buildings, and so on. But first and foremost, we had to demonstrate that there was interest from industry. So we had to get commitments from our industry partners, you know, people like Ford and Hyundai and 3M and ADM and small companies. And once we did that, then NSF gave us a grant to start CB Squared. Now, about a year ago, I left and came up to NDSU and falling in love with Fargo. And we brought this the leadership of the center up from Iowa State to NDSU. Iowa State remains a site and has a site director there, Eric Cochran. We have a site director here at NDSU, Dean Webster. And we also have a site director at UGA who also joined about the same time as NDSU. So we have four sites, but each site has a specific type of technology that's unique. So when we add a site to one of these centers, we don't want to be a me too. It has to be a new technology. And so NDSU's had a long history in coatings and polymers. It dates back many, many years. And so one of the things that we're bringing to this is trying to develop technologies that are taking biomass and using them for coatings. And so, you know, we have that technology here. And so, for example, one of the member companies that NDSU's brought in is Sherwin-Williams. One can imagine that they may have an interest in coatings and paints. You know, as well as somebody like BASF, who just recently joined the center as well. So that's what's unique about NDSU is that area, as well as synthesis of thermoset materials.
You're holding in your hand what is a pot for plants, and I assume that was produced from research at Iowa State, where you came from previously. Because what's unique about this?
Yeah, so this pot, you know, this work started a long time ago, but it was really through CB Squared that we're able to commercialize this. And it's a pot that's produced from soybeans and corn. And when we first started this project, we tried to make them out of strictly soybean because we knew that the soy protein would be high in nitrogen and this pot would be self-fertilizing. So you wouldn't have to add any type of synthetic fertilizer or an additional fertilizer to the plant to make it grow healthy. Unfortunately, we found out early on that soy protein itself is very water soluble, and the pots would turn basically to tofu. And so that didn't work out so well. And also, it just didn't hold up. So we landed up finding a composite. So this is the research part of a corn and soybean composite. And so now if the pot feels like a traditional petrochemical pot.
Yes, it does. It looks like it, yep. Too.
And growers like this because, one, the mass growers don't necessarily have a real strong affinity towards paper pots or moss-based pots because they are relatively weak. You can push your thumb through the wall. But more importantly, they also wick the water. So they have to use a lot more water in their greenhouses because the water wicks through this. In this case, this thing's water stable, so it retains the water. They don't have to use as much water. And also, it's biodegradable. And again, I got to be careful about that, but it is degradable in the environment. But also, it self-fertilizes because it has some of that soy protein that has that nitrogen and the amino acids. But one thing that came out of this that we had no anticipation of foreseeing was it stops root circling. So traditionally, if you're like me and you're a gardener, you go to the shop and you buy your tomato plants.
And you forget to put it in the ground.
Well, there's always that. That happens every once in a while, too.
If you let it go in the pot, it's going to get root bound, isn't it?
Yeah. So the plant just has this root circle, what we call root circling. And so if you're, you know, a gardener like me and my wife, first thing you do is you dig your hole and then you pop the pot off of this thing and then you grab onto the root ball and you tear at it. And you're probably damaging a lot of the roots. And then you put the ball into the dirt and cover it. And then hopefully in 3 or 4 months, you can harvest your tomatoes. Well, one thing that came out of this that we had no anticipation of foreseeing was that this stops root circling. And all the roots land up being pointing outward, and so you're not damaging it.
Because they're looking for the nitrogen and other stuff.
Yeah, there's a couple of different theories of why that's occurring. I'm a polymer processing, not a horticulturist. And there's been some theories about, it's this fertilizing effect is stopping that, and it doesn't need to. But it also does produce more root nodules. So you take the pot off, and you don't have to tear up the roots. We recommend that you crush the remaining of the pot and crush it up with your hands, put it in the bottom of the hole because it still has fertilizing effects and it's going to degrade, and put the plant on top and cover it. And then 3 or 4 months later, you're actually going to see about a 100% increase in the yield of tomatoes and peppers because that root ball is just so much healthier compared to one that had root circling.
That's a neat solution to an interesting set of problems, actually.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a much bigger and global issue, though, and that is plastic everywhere, whole islands of it in the oceans and washing up on beaches all the time.
Yep.
The kind of plastic that doesn't biodegrade or certainly doesn't get out of our sight very soon. What kind of research are you looking at that might deal with this issue?
Yeah. You know, that's a really good question. And it's a very interesting topic to get into. You know, I always use the 5 R's, you know, about this problem. There is not going to be one solution to this problem. And I'm also very careful of talking about biodegradability and that that's going to help solve that problem because we wouldn't want to have anybody jump in and think, oh, okay, it's degradable. I can throw it out in the ocean and it'll just naturally disappear and I'll be happy and I don't have to worry about it. We don't want to promote any thought process that it's okay to throw anything into the ocean or freshwater or whatever we're talking about. So I'm very, very careful about talking about whether or not that's going to be a solution to this. But just plastics waste in general, I think there's the 5 R's that I really emphasize. You know, one is reuse and repurpose and reduce and then, recycle and then renewable. You know, if we focus on those 5 things, we can probably make a big dent on this problem that we're seeing with all these plastics in the ocean.
When I went up on the website that is describes CB2, this center that is at NDSU and other universities around the country, I saw a list of research projects that were underway, and a lot of them were Iowa State and Washington, those big land-grant institutions. And I am assuming this is going to – your movement here is looked at as making some opportunities, research opportunities, expanding this particular area of research at NDSU.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I wouldn't say it was me. I mean, these opportunities existed here well before I got here. You know, Dean Webster over in the Department of Polymers and Coatings, he's been doing just great research over the many years. And Chad Olvin in mechanical engineering, working on bio-based composites and hemp and so on. And so that's always been here. Maybe the center is going to act as a little bit of a catalyst to help bring industry into this. But these talents have always been here.
What are the potential for students, undergraduates and graduate students who are interested in bioplastics?
That's a good question. There's actually a lot of opportunity. You know, the National Science Foundation Center, they really focus on not only developing new ideas and concepts, but also making sure that we're educating. And so within the center, there's a couple different things. We've historically run an RU program, which is a research experience for undergraduates. And we just submitted a new proposal for that to continue on with NDSU as part of that. And during that, what happens is we recruit students from all over the United States and from other universities, and we bring them into one of the sites. And they work with the faculty members, with the graduate students to help conduct the research. And we have a cohort that goes through that. They take classes on sustainable materials. They have to do a poster session at the end and so on. And so what we find, though, is that experience really helps embed the idea of going on to graduate school. 80% of the students that participate in the RU program go on to become graduate students. NSF also funds internships, both for undergraduate and graduate students. So if a member company, whether that's Ford or ADM or BASF or whoever it is, and all the 29 companies that we have within CB Squared, if they want to have an internship, NSF will, in part, if not fully, depending on the budget at the time, pay for that internship, whether that's salary or travel or housing.
Well, you mentioned Sherwin-Williams being invested in, you know, paint and coatings and things like that at NDSU. So there's industry interest in this. NSF, National Science Foundation, is providing some grant support for projects it sees as useful. Mm-hmm. How about the state of North Dakota? Will you be asking the state for some help as well?
Traditionally, we don't typically ask the state. We know the federal government is funding this. And so, you know, it would be nice if there would be some opportunities there for that to happen. You know, I could foresee some opportunities where maybe the state would help smaller companies that are struggling to get into the area of sustainability and helping with on that side of it. I think that would be a potential. But
more of an incubator approach to building new industry in the state?
Yeah, it certainly could be. Because at the end of the day, we don't want to have this be a bunch of science projects. We want to have this be economic development. We want to produce jobs. We want to produce income for the state of North Dakota.
So you're bullish on bioplastics.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And if you were looking ahead 5 or 10 years, what would you see the industry potential in North Dakota?
Well, I think that there's a lot of feedstocks we have. You mentioned the sugar beets. You know, this is a relatively new feedstock for me. I grew up in Ohio, lived in Germany for a while, and then lived in Iowa for many years. And so sugar beets, I visited the local sugar processing plant last fall, and it was fascinating to see how they take sugar beets and turn them into white sugar for table use. And so, you know, you see the waste streams that are coming off there. There could be opportunities there. And there's also enormous opportunities within the co-products from corn and soybeans.
You're going to be hearing a lot about bioplastics if David Gruhl has anything to say about it. He's the professor and chair of the Department of Industrial and Manufacturing Engineering at NDSU, and it is Bioplastics Week, September 23rd to the 27th. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, I thank you.
Coming up next, a Plainsfolk essay from NDSU history professor Tom Ezern.
Michael Wood explores 4,000 years of China.
They're anxious to place themselves in the world as a force for good.
Discover how technology can make it easier to travel.
You just hold the button, you speak into it, and it translates on the screen in real time.
And take your kids to Europe.
People are so kind to kids everywhere, really fun.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern likes to travel and he loves to tell stories. His Plainsfolk essays are a Main Street feature that he voices to share bits of history that relate to where we live. Today's essay is about travel and discoveries and stories. It's titled Real Things in Real Places.
Spend less, see more. This has been the candid and standard advice dispensed for 25 years by Seth Kugel, author of The Frugal Traveler in the New York Times. Now, in book form, under the title Rediscovering Travel, A Guide for the Globally Curious, Kugel codifies his practical approach to travel, updates it to deal with the modern, digitally dependent travel industry, and gets philosophical about the experience of travel. I'm thinking there's quite a bit here to inform travel not just globally, but also close to home on the prairies. I say this as a traveler myself, and as one who labors to build the enterprise of grassroots heritage tourism on the Great Plains of North America. The Frugal Traveler begins his book in a tidy but fraying town on the Great Hungarian Plain, where he noses around to find something interesting to experience and write about. And immediately my mind ranges to the American Plains out my back door. I think about the day I pulled into Alice, North Dakota, which I wish I had described at the time as, in Kugel's fine phrase, a fraying town, looking for some historical artifacts and failed to find them. Just as I was about to leave town, an old man sitting in front of the bar called out to me, "I thought you were going to ask me about my leg." So I asked him about his leg, and he rolled up his trouser leg to expose a prosthetic limb emblazoned with a John Deere logo. I've been telling the story about asking fool questions, the resilience of old men, brand loyalty, and the John Deere leg ever since. Similarly, I love to tell the story how Suzanne and I were driving down the coast of New South Wales when we saw smoke belching from a stack in a farm town. Diverting, we found a sugarcane processing plant with trucks lined up, waiting to dump loads of chopped cane. So then Suzanne says, "Why don't we follow one of them?" Which we do. Racing across the coastal plains with Dr. Kelly at the wheel like a bat out of hell, ending up in a cane field wherein self-propelled cane cutters were making the rounds. I tucked my way into the cab of one of them and made a few rounds. It's always a mistake to leave Suzanne alone in a place like that, because when I dismounted from the cane chopper, there she was at the center of a circle of guys, all of them being regaled by the boss of the crew telling stories to her. I won't go too deep into this, but a bag of bush lemons played a key part in the narrative. This is the kind of thing, near or far, that Kugel encourages us to get into. He travels around the world, but also takes delight with a Flint Hills livestock auction he wanders into in Coffee County, Kansas. "It is time," writes Kugel, "that we leave a little more of our vacation to chance, take a few extra risks, welcome a bit of unease. In other words, escape the false premise of the modern travel industry, everything conveniently packaged, familiar, and controlled, exactly like the real world isn't. You have to," he says, "dare to adjust your plans when an intriguing possibility materializes and make those plans flexible in the first place." Well, amen to that. I've always said the motto for grassroots tourism on the Great Plains should be real things in real places. Step it up a notch. This is Kugel's challenge. Talk to strangers. Eat the lutefisk or lamb fries. You don't need to live dangerously, but live. Oh, and by the way, if you come back from a prairie adventure with stories to tell, come on into my Facebook group for prairie travelers, Heritage Trails, and tell us about them. I'll warn you, the first liar doesn't have a chance. Just keep it real.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear another personal story from the Breaking Barriers Oral History Project by the Red River Rainbow Seniors. And we'll talk about the upcoming North Dakota LGBTQ Plus Summit. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A coalition dedicated to ending hunger in North Dakota is celebrating its 10th anniversary. The Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition held a summit at the state capitol in Bismarck Tuesday. Karen Ahrens is the coalition's coordinator.
We need to keep that vision in mind, and our vision is a hunger-free state. And the only way that we'll be able to move that needle is by working together.
Aaron says the state's food insecurity rates have been inching upward, even though groups like the Great Plains Food Bank have been providing more food for those who need it.
Some of the reasons we think that are contributing are the fact that we've lost 20% of our grocery stores in small rural towns, that we have overall the state doing well, and some people's incomes perhaps putting them just above the threshold to qualify for some of the federal assistance programs.
Aaron says the coalition is now looking at some action plans to tackle the problem. The BNSF Railway is offering a reward for information leading to the arrest of who's responsible for vandalizing railroad tracks near Fargo. The damages occurred in the vicinity of a railroad crossing near Cass County Road 20. BNSF spokeswoman Amy McBeth says the damages were found Monday during a routine track inspection.
What we're asking is if anyone has information about that incident or a person involved in that incident, we want them to contact our crime tip hotline as we work through that investigation. We would really appreciate hearing from folks if they have any information that's relevant.
The railroad is offering a $2,500 reward. If you have information, you can call the BNSF Crime Tip Hotline at 1-800-832-5452. Again, that's 800-832-5452. And the North Dakota Department of Health is getting ahead of this year's flu season by encouraging everyone to get vaccinated early. Governor Doug Burgum spoke at a news conference at the state capitol and received his own flu shot on site. He says last year there were about 8,000 reported cases of influenza reported to the state health department, but not every person who falls ill is tested, so that number is probably low. He says getting vaccinated and preventing yourself from getting the flu can protect everyone around you. Angie Wirkan says her otherwise healthy 2.5-year-old daughter Gianna fell ill from the flu in 2015 and she did not recover.
When she passed away in less than 48 hours from the flu, less than 48 hours after presenting her first symptom of a slight fever, I am not alone. There are many other parents just like me who have lost children to the flu. And many of those parents made the conscious decision not to vaccinate. I think many people out there think that this can't happen to them based simply on the probability that their child won't be the one to die from the flu. I stand before you today as Gianna's mom. I am proof it does happen, and it happens far too often.
Flu vaccines can be administered by primary health care providers, local public health units, and at many pharmacies. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The second annual North Dakota LGBTQ Plus Summit is coming up October 4th through the 6th in Mandan. One of the presentations will feature the Breaking Barriers Oral History Project by the Red River Rainbow Seniors. Excerpts from that project are edited by Prairie Public to become the Breaking Barriers podcast. Today we share another episode as we hear from David Fisher, who was born in South Dakota in 1950, but soon moved to North Dakota, growing up when being gay was problematic. He attended NDSU, enjoyed a 38-year career working in area hospitals, and retired in 2012.
Looking back, I knew I was gay, but I had no idea what that was when I was young. I had no reference to that. It was a time when very few people, I think, in this area talked about it. Well, yes, certainly talked about it, but I'm not sure people even really knew much about it. They certainly knew that or felt that same-sex relationships were wrong, that they focused on the main Bible verses that we know and have heard. So anyway, the teaching that I had just profoundly affected me and allowed me to have this brainwashed mindset. And the main reason I was closeted for such a long time and closeted for such a long time to myself was the religious teaching that I had, I was in profound denial of my sexuality, even to myself. It's hard for people to understand this, but that's how profoundly my belief was, that I was not gay and that I couldn't be. It was just such an awful thing to even think of being that. I remember trying to pray these feelings away, trying to rationalize them away, trying to believe that other boys grew up like this, had feelings like this, and would just outgrow it. You never do, of course. I was married when I turned, when I was about 26. We were married for 26, 27 years, and I loved her a great deal. As I mentioned, I was 50 years old. By the time I admitted to myself that I was gay, it was just such a eye-opening moment. I remember being depressed, severely depressed at that time, and of course I had gone through a lot of depression. I felt awful about myself. I just didn't have any value. It's difficult to explain, but I was severely depressed and suicidal, and I knew that I had to reach deep down. And figure out what was causing this. And there was just one moment I remember looking deep into myself, and it just came to me. It was like the clouds opened up and it just began pouring rain. The knowledge of being gay just came to me, and admitting that was an experience that I remember feeling like this was the best moment of my life, and also the worst moment of my life. Because 50 years, for 50 years I had lived and suffered so much and missed out on so much, and I had lied to my wife and my daughter. They had no idea that I was gay, and my wife, she never really thought that I was gay. It never crossed her mind, I guess. That's how well I had hidden that part of my life. And, of course, she was in, I'm sure, some denial as well. But we loved each other. We were wonderful, good friends. We still are, now that we're divorced. I actually wanted to stay married. I thought we could work this out. It was a rough time for me. And for several years after, I felt so alone and abandoned. I eventually came out at work, and I worked in operating rooms all the time, and oh, had lots of friends there, but there was a lot of joking, gay jokes, just derogatory things said about gay people, and eventually I had heard enough, and I felt like I could just let people know how I felt. So one morning, I asked for a few minutes at the beginning of the meeting to just speak about something, and I stood in the front, told people that some of the things in the workplace that I had been hearing had been really hurtful, and I told them it was the, you know, the gay slang, the slurs, the jokes. I said those things are very hurtful to me because I'm gay, and you can imagine the silence and the focus of attention. I said, this might be very, very hard for you to understand. I'm married, have a daughter, seem to be, you know, living the normal heterosexual life, but I have been hiding this from not only everyone, but from myself as well, and I needed them to help me feel better about myself and look upon my situation in a positive light. And it was rather, you know, a short period of time that I took, maybe 5 minutes or so. Anyway, I left the meeting at that time to just kind of collect my thoughts. And when the meeting ended, several people came up to me and apologized. I'm sorry, I'm getting so emotional. But people had started to apologize to me, treated me completely differently. They were wonderful. I don't think there was anyone there who was thinking negatively of me, because I had been a good employee, worked really hard, tried to, you know, get along well, which I did. Before I came out, I was, you know, generally really well liked anyway, and they knew that I was a good person, so them coming to terms with this was almost as hard as it was for me. They needed an education too, and they learned a lot over the next 16, 17 years that I worked with them. So that was probably the most powerful thing that I had ever done as far as standing up for myself and others who were like me. I just wanted to open people's eyes. I wasn't ashamed of myself any longer. I was proud of who I was. I was stronger. I was a person who finally was fighting back. I was finished being bullied.
That's David Fisher in an excerpt from the Red River Rainbow Seniors Oral History Project called Breaking Barriers, Harvesting LGBTQ Stories from the Northern Plains. It's an ongoing project, and if you wish to get involved, you can email redriverrainboworalhistory@gmail.com. The histories will be archived at North Dakota State University. And to hear other episodes of the Breaking Barriers podcast, you can go to prairiepublic.org, click on Listen, and select Podcasts. Joining us now are Cindy Roholt, who conducted that interview and is one of the planners for an upcoming summit that we just mentioned, and Mandan. Cindy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, David.
Interesting and provocative interview and got our attention. And Christina Linseth joins us by phone. She's also an organizer for the upcoming LGBTQ plus summit. Cindy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, Christina, who should attend the summit?
I would encourage anyone who is looking to advocate for the LGBT community in the state of North Dakota, who is looking to network, if they already are advocating, youth from teenage, so 14 years of age and up could benefit because there will be sessions now where they are going to be able to connect a network. There is going to be a plenary session from law enforcement from Fargo PD, so law enforcement would be could learn from this experience. Really, any working professional who is wanting to learn about more about the community and the people that they work with from the LGBTQ community.
Law enforcement in Fargo does have that, as you mentioned, liaison office, and so that's an interesting development in law enforcement. Cindy, what would you call the overarching themes of this particular summit?
Well, this year really the focus is on youth, mental health, and advocacy for the LGBTQ community.
And let's pick that apart a bit.
Sure.
Youth.
Youth. Well, we've got some national partners that are coming to join with us. We're very pleased to be able to have representatives from the Trevor Project, which is a leading national organization that provides crisis intervention and suicide prevention services to LGBTQ youth under 25, and also from the National Center for Lesbian Rights, not just for lesbians. But there will be breakout sessions that will really involve what's going on with youth, what their issues are, creating some safe spaces for them, just how and their families. One of the representatives that's coming from the National Center for Lesbian Rights is a nationally recognized leader and advocate for transgender youth nationally. So we're really partnering with some people that can bring some expertise that is of particular interest to youth.
And Christina, advocacy is an important issue, as Cindy mentioned here. The state of North Dakota, the legislature, has been a bit of a barrier for some of the legislation that your community is interested in. How are you going to work on that?
I think a big piece of it, from just standpoint of the networking piece, knowing what's going on the other side of the state, and knowing what resources actually exist on any part of the state is important. Visibility, how to be able to tell your story in a way that is effective so that people can understand why it matters, why visibility matters. Those are some of the focuses of some of the other plenary sessions, as well as how to tell my story, as well as just knowing that, okay, there are organizations in now Watford City that are trying to build a youth program. How can we on Fargo's side, based off of what we have learned in having programming of a similar nature, help our neighbors across the state essentially bring that to fruition? And so that's why bringing everyone from across the state together is so important, because that in itself is advocacy at work.
Cindy, you mentioned the agenda and youth mental health advocacy being the principal themes. There is an agenda item called Mapping the Environment, which has three breakdowns. The Story of Me, we heard one with David Fisher there, the Red River Rainbow Project, The Story of Us, The Story of Now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear a little bit about that.
Well, you know, really, we're looking at drawing people from all across North Dakota. Last year, we had representation from Williston, Fargo, Minot, Bismarck, Newtown, Fort Yates, places in between. We've got a youth group coming from Williston this year. So we're really looking at, you know, the primary motivation behind the summit in planning it is to really help people across the state come together for mutual support, to see what's happening in different parts of the state, also to get training and support, and plan collective action about what needs to be done, you know, really defining those needs. That's kind of what that mapping our environment is about, is taking a look at, you know, what are people in Williston seeing as change? How does that compare to what's going on in Fargo? Maybe there's some things that are happening in Minot that will bring insight into what's being done in other parts of the state.
Christina, in my lifetime, this issue has evolved from homosexual and lots of derogatory comments about that lifestyle to gay and lesbian to now we have LGBTQ+. So we're talking here about a spectrum. An individual experience of personal sexuality or orientation, whatever. That's an important message too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Just knowing how inclusive of, I joke about it as being the alphabet soup of the community because the acronym is quite extensive, and it's gender identity, sexual orientation, all that is outside of the typical binary that has been the conversation for so long. And that in itself is knowledge that people are still learning about. The other day, I had someone who is well connected within the LGBT community ask me, well, what does the I stand for in that acronym, which is a little bit farther down in the list, but okay, well, that means someone who's intersex. Okay, well, they at least knew what that meant, but just knowing what the letter within the full acronym meant, it's that educational process that continues every day in terms of people asking those questions and wanting to know more. But at least the conversations are now being had, which is so important. Again, the visibility and being able to talk about it more freely and more openly than we were even, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and moving beyond the fact that it's not a lifestyle choice. This is people's identities that they have known from since they were very little, and how to be interactive with everybody and not have to continue to explain that over and over again. These are strides that we are making.
In my own personal ongoing education about this, I'm beginning to wonder if human sexuality, that personal experience we all have, isn't just as unique as a fingerprint.
Absolutely. It can be. When you think about there's your gender identity, there's also your gender expression, and that can be different for every person. And there's really not, I think, what confuses people is, well, but they don't behave this way and they make comparisons because they're trying to fit it into a box so they can categorize. There isn't a box. There's not a rule to say you have to behave this way to identify this way. And once you can understand and accept that primary principle, then the rest of the education becomes much more simplified because you're not trying to continue to compare it to everything that you knew before, but just accept it as this is a person who is living and being and trying to exist and not just exist but thrive in their community.
Cindy, where can people find out more information about the summit and the issues connected with it?
Really easy. We've got a website. It's www.ndlgbtqsummit.com. You can go there to learn more about the agenda of what's going on for the 3 days. This starts on October 4th and ends on October 6th. It's going to be in Mandan at the Baymont Inn. And you can find all the information that you need there. There's information about the major presenters as well as information about lodging. I'd also like to mention something that's not up on the website that I just recently learned, that we have been approved for CEUs, which is continuing education units, through the North Dakota Board of Social Work Examiners. And our approval through the North Dakota Board of Addiction Counseling Examiners is pending. So that may indeed come through before the summit, too. So if someone's looking to get CEUs, they are available for attending.
Cindy Roholt and Christina Linseth are organizers of the upcoming LGBTQ+ Summit in Mandan, October 4th through the 6th. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 24th. The SS Admiral Sampson was a cargo and passenger steamship built for the American Mail Steamship Company in 1898. In 1909, both the Sampson and her sister ship, the Farragut, were purchased by the Alaska Pacific Steamship Company. Based in San Francisco, they provided passenger and cargo service between that city and the Puget Sound, and sometimes all the way to Alaska. The Admiral Sampson set out from Seattle on August 26, 1914, making a run to Juneau. There were 126 passengers on board. The fog was thick as the ship made its way out of Seattle. At the same time, the Princess Victoria was inbound. In spite of both captains exercising extreme caution, the Victoria broadsided the Sampson. The Victoria was not in danger of sinking, but there was a large gash in the Sampson, and that ship was going down. Both ships launched lifeboats. When a fire broke out on the Sampson, Captain Moore had passengers dropped over the side so they could be picked up by the boats. He ordered the crew to abandon ship, but he stayed on board. The telegraph operator remained at his post, transmitting calls for help. Both men went down with the ship. On this date in 1914, North Dakotans learned that a trunk had washed ashore from the shipwreck. It bore the name of J. McLaughlin. Inside were clothes as well as personal papers. Reports of this find led North Dakotans to surmise that a Mr. and Mrs. James McLaughlin and their five children, who had lived for several years around Arvilla, North Dakota, had been on board the doomed ship. The Grand Forks Daily Herald suggested that the entire family may have perished, but there was no confirmation. Rumors abounded about the shipwreck, and confusion was evident in the reporting. The Warwick News reported 700 casualties. This was a wild exaggeration. The official death toll was 12. One article identified an Ezra Byrne as both a stowaway and a member of the crew. Was it another mistake that a man named John McLaughlin was listed as your casualty? He was last seen clinging to the rigging as the ship went down. Could that actually have been the James McLaughlin of the North Dakota McLaughlin family? Regardless, the report of the trunk brought the shipwreck close to home for landlocked North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher and Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Wednesday on Main Street, according to a recent survey, many young adults lack some of the basic skills needed to live on their own. We'll talk with educator Linda Smith about those life skills, why they get neglected, and what can be done. Sue Balcom will join us tomorrow for another Main Street Eats conversation, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.